Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
A Living History production.
I'm Peter Hart.
And I'm Gary Bain.
And together we're Pete and Gary's Military History
Podcast.
Hello, hello, and welcome to the podcast. A rather sad occasion today. I'm here with Peter Hart. That's always quite sad. And I'm Gary Bain. And today, Pete, today is the last in the series on the Arras Air War.
It's a tragic day for us.
And this is entitled May Endgame.
Ooh, May Endgame.
May my game be end.
Well, it's the end. So where are we? What's happening is that on the 1st of May, Haig, General Sir Douglas Haig, Commander BEF, orders General Sir Edward Allenby.
Edmund.
Did I say Edward again? I've done that 1,000 times. Which army is he in charge of, Gary?
Third Army.
That's right. And Hubert Gough.
Fifth Army.
Oh, you forget. And Henry Home.
First Army. Henry Horne, isn't it?
Oh, what is the matter with me today? Told you I couldn't see. Might be something to do with the weekend's activities.
So what did he order them to do?
Well, he orders them to launch an immediate offensive starting on the 3rd of May. And what springs to your mind? Any big project, what springs to your mind? 1st of May is ordered to start on 3rd of May. Come on, Gary, you can do this. What is it? What is it, Gary? What is it that you think when you're told that?
Well, it's 2 days, so not enough time to prepare.
Yeah, it's ridiculous, isn't it? Why is Haig doing this?
Well, he really didn't have any choice if the French army was to survive as a meaningful force in the field. Just as the Royal Flying Corps had had to make sacrifices for the common cause in April... Now in May, the British Army must fight what would be known as the Third Battle of the Scarpe and the Second Battle of Bullecourt for the overall greater good of the Allied powers. We've said this before.
Yeah, the French mutinies are serious. I'm not sure anyone quite knew how serious. I'm not sure the Germans knew. Always found that strange. They never heard that was, you know. It's just got to happen, though. The British don't have a lot of choice. So what does this mean? New offensive? What does that mean for the Royal Flying Corps?
Well, for the umpteenth time, the reconnaissance aircraft and artillery observation aircraft took to the skies. But one thing had changed.
What's that, Gary? What? What had changed?
Well, at long last, the much-delayed RE8s were beginning to arrive in an ever-increasing stream. Though, of course, all the BE2s couldn't be replaced overnight.
No. So, but they're coming on. So they've been coming on stream for so long that they're actually fairly obsolescent by the time they arrive. They haven't really, in my view, got the manoeuvrability and speed and the rest of it required in the Arras skies. They're pretty dangerous skies, aren't they? But what's the difference, do you think, in the end, between the RE8 and the BE2C?
Well, the RE8's certainly faster and more powerful than any of the BE2s.
Yeah. And another thing is, when a new plane arrives, everybody always calls it a spinning incinerator.
Oh, it's rubbish. It's a death trap.
Death trap. But usually that's just the pilots getting used to a new aircraft. And the other thing is, if you're giving up something you understand and you know everything about, you understand the fault, how to open. You're looking at me as if you're thinking of giving me up.
It's like giving up an old friend.
But at least you know and understand it. The BATC, you knew it was shit, but you sort of had a modus operandi, Gary. A modus operandi.
Is that French?
Latin.
Meanwhile, new plans were under development to try and increase the effectiveness of scout attacks on the German kite balloons that still provided them with observation over much of the Arras battlefield.
So why is this a problem? Why are kite balloons a problem?
Well, as ever, the balloons are defended by an interlinked combination of anti-aircraft batteries, machine guns, flaming onions.
There's nothing worse than setting fire to an onion and throwing it at an aircraft.
Oh, I thought that's something you'd get a cream for.
Oh, wow.
And lurking German scouts. Lurking German scouts. With a new phase in the offensive looming, it was once again vital to put out these unblinking German eyes that peered down on the British preparations.
Why do we call it unblinking?
Well, because it's always there. Now, we've said before, they can't be everywhere because there just wasn't enough of them. But they were out trying to do exactly the same as the British were trying to do.
And the thing about kite balloons is they don't have to go down and refuel. They're just up there. They're always there.
They're always there unless you do something about them.
Ooh, so what's the plan? What are they going to do about them?
Well, Major Leonard Tilney, who was commanding 40 Squadron, he came up with a plan to subvert these defences by making a concerted low-level attack.
Now, his squadron, they begin a period of intensive training. First, they don't know why they're doing it, and nobody tells them. And you're going to be one of the great heroes of the Royal Flying Corps, but who's still an enjoy. He's new to the game.
Is that Latin? No, that's French.
And you're going to be Second Lieutenant Edward Mannock. Who's in Tilney's 40 Squadron?
A new game is being evolved. It comprises the act of rushing all out, and by all out is meant opening the engine throttle to its fullest power around houses, chimneys, barracks, tents, hills and valleys, trees and telegraph poles at a height from the ground of anything less than 10 feet. Blimey, 10 feet. Sorry, that's me. Mannock goes on, nothing more exciting could be imagined. And when one considers the speed of these machines, just guess what it means.
Well, I'm guessing the word brown trousers would follow on if we had to do it. It sounds terrifying to me.
10 feet, Pete, 10 feet. Well, you're nearly 10 feet tall, aren't you?
No, but I know what you mean. Well, what's this roof in here, 8 feet? It's ridiculous. It's terrifying. And what happens if you don't see something?
Now, Mannock, he flew on the second of the missions, Ooh. And he goes on to say, went over the line from north of Arras to 5 miles behind the German trenches at a height of less than 15 feet, attacking Hun balloons. Six of us, Captain Nixon, Hall, Scudamore, Redler, Parry and myself. All except the captain returned safely, but with machines almost shot to pieces. Hall crashed on home aerodrome, as did Scudamore. Parry crashed just outside of the lines at Canadian headquarters. Redler crashed at Savvy, but returned here later and damaged his machine on landing. I was the only one to return properly to the aerodrome and made a perfect landing. We got all our objectives. My fuselage had bullet holes in it, one very near my head, and the wings were more or less riddled. I don't want to go through such an experience again.
Well, and I don't blame him, but, I mean, he's a thoughtful chap, and I think he can... balloon busting was always regarded as the most dangerous of all the aerial pursuits, if you like. There's nothing more dangerous. Now, the last major offensive, this is the Battle of Arras, so the third Battle of Scarpe, starts on the 3rd of May. The 1st, 3rd and 5th armies all go over the top on a 16-mile front spreading from Vimy Ridge to Bullecourt. Is this like the 9th of April? Is it like the 9th of April? Is it, Gary?
Well, not at all, because the lack of time in making the preparation, it proved a fatal handicap. The British artillery bombardment was frankly inadequate. The counter-battery arrangements skimped. Most of the assaulting troops were not fresh. Those that were had no chance to practice or assimilate their orders. Worst of all, the German defensive positions and wire were mostly intact. and garrisoned by largely fresh divisions of equal numbers.
Oh, God. So let's put it simply. What would you say the scene was set for?
Dun, dun, dun. Disaster. It could not have been more different from the precision planning, careful preparation and annihilation bombardment that had brought such a dramatic success on the 9th of April. And this is what Sergeant Jack Cousins of the 7th Bedfordshire and Hertfordshire Regiment says.
Our orders didn't get through until the last minute, and then they were all garbled. No one, including our officers, seemed to know what we were supposed to be doing or where we were going. Officers were supposed to have synchronised their watches, insofar as it was possible at that time of day. At a certain time, our barrage was supposed to lift, and we were to climb out of the trenches and go forward. Well, we did, but it wasn't all at the same time. We were given false information and told the artillery had smashed the enemy defences and we would get through the wire. Did we, Ellis-like?
So that was the northern platoon of the Bedfordshire and Hertfordshire Red.
Well, you're always going on and on about me being born in Luton.
Now, one exception was on the northern flank where the Canadians
northern
managed a small advance at terrible cost to take the village of Fresnoy, whilst alongside them the 31st Division pushed towards Oppy Wood.
Now, the only other success was made by the Australians of Gough's 5th Army, who managed to get a small lodgment of troops through the German lines. What do you think the Germans did? Small lodgment? What should we do now, says the German High Command?
Well, as always, the Germans threw in numerous counterattacks, and this tactically insignificant gain that provoked so much suffering was not finally secured for another 2 weeks of the murderous attritional fighting that became the Second Battle of Bullecourt.
Which you know, is the Australians are not happy about the whole thing, are they? Now, in the fighting in the northern area, the Sopwith 1.5 strutters, our favourites!
Not the 1.5-inch strutter, then?
No, not the 1.5-inch strutters. Our favourite aircraft, the best ever name that's ever been given to any aircraft. They're given something new to do, something new. What was that?
Well, they were expected to try to assist the struggling infantry. Counterattack patrols flying low down behind the captured positions to report immediately on German preparations for counterattacks, then do their utmost to hold them back.
Well, you're going to be Major Sholto Douglas. Now, he commands 43 Squadron RFC. What does he say?
We flew at heights varying from 50 to 300 feet, shooting up and bombing scattered parties of the enemy troops, trench positions and transport. On one occasion, I came down very low and started shooting at a row of German heads that had appeared along the top of a parapet. They shook me a little by answering back, and I could distinctly hear the popping sound of small arms fire flashing past my ears. Our success appeared to be mainly due to the enemies being so startled by the audacity of our attack and bombardment that they could not bring themselves to throw at us any very heavy fire. The Sopwith 1.5 strutter came into its own.
I know, that's what I've written, isn't it?
Its performance and manoeuvrability near the ground being good, and the chief danger that we had to face was from our own artillery barrage. When we shut off our engines for a moment, we could clearly hear our own shells rumbling past our ears with a noise that sounded like a succession of trains passing through a tunnel.
Yeah, the 1.5 strutter, see, it's not powerful enough at altitude, but low down it's fast enough, it's good enough for this task. So basically, is there a German counterattack coming? And if there is, you just dive down, you machine gun, you use small 20-pound bombs, that kind of Cooper bombs, that kind of thing. What else is happening now? What do they need? The fighting's going on. So what do they need? They still need photography and artillery observation.
We've said this time and time and time again how important that is. Now, the crippling losses of the RFC, therefore, continued throughout May, and eventually almost every RFC and RNAS mess was hit hard. And this is Captain Ewart Garland of 10 Squadron RFC. Poor old Lorimer and his observer were brought down by Archie this morning, both killed, crashed outside of the lines. We buried Lorimer and Osborne. Machines were taking off and landing at our aerodrome. It seems fitting to see and hear machines when burying an airman. Poor little Weeks crashed into trees on the edge of the aerodrome when coming into land on practice night flying. Burst into flames. Finny. Watson got lost night flying. Crashed miles away but not hurt. We buried Weeks today. I was a pallbearer as yesterday, and our machines were flying above as if looking at the scene. Directly we got back from the funeral, Bulmer and I went up and were 3 hours doing a shoot for 6-inch howitzers.
That was a bit insensitive of me. I shouldn't have made that gag. Apologise for that.
But what that does show is, you know, in amongst death, their duties go on. You know, they come back from a funeral straight up.
Yeah, but they wouldn't have been human if they didn't. Who would think of yourself as a young serving? Say you were in the RFC. Who would you blame for what's happening?
Well, I'd blame everybody, but I think they nurtured some antipathy towards the staff officers that they knew were ultimately responsible for sending them up time after time to photograph seemingly minute changes in the German defences. And one of our old favourites, Second Lieutenant Charles Smart, was given a very rare opportunity to let the staff see what it was like far above the trenches. And this is what Second Lieutenant Charles Smart of 5 Squadron says.
Off we went with an intelligence officer in each machine. My passenger, Staff Captain McLeod, complete with his DSO, MC and red tabs. McLeod knew nothing about aerial gunnery and had never seen a Hun machine in his life. In fact, he'd only been up in the air once before, so I couldn't expect very much from him. He means as a rear gunner. We had no sooner got well... actually, rear gunner, it's a B2C probably, so it's four in front. We no sooner got well over the lines when 6 Huns swooped down on us from nowhere and a rare mix-up followed. The Huns were, of course, 2-1, so we at once turned west and made a running fight of it. A Hun settled himself on my tail and started shooting. I just threw my old floating fort about as though it was a scout, finishing up with a dive of about 130 miles per hour. McLeod is a very stout fellow, but an awful fool. When I got in the dive, the Hun was still sticking to us and shooting. I looked over my shoulder and McLeod was sitting with a "what do I do next" expression on his face. I jerked the throttle back so that he could hear and yelled, "Shoot, you darned fool, shoot!" He then got busy with his gun and fired straight through our own rudder post. Fortunately for us, 5 of our triplanes, that's Sopwith triplanes, turned up just in the nick of time and we got away. It was a close call and I'm afraid we should have been dead meat if the scouts hadn't turned up and saved us. We went to dinner at Corps headquarters at night. McLeod related the details of the fight with great gusto, saying nothing about the rudder incident. Of course, I did not let him down, but no more amateur observers for me if I can help it. Wow. That used to happen a lot because you're going dagger, 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 tracking the German plane. And of course, you've got your rudder just behind you.
And the British scouts helped when they could, but the overarching demands of the RFC offensive doctrine meant that they simply couldn't be everywhere. They continued to fly offensive patrols deep behind the German lines, seeking out the German scouts and army cooperation aircraft before they could get to the vital areas above the lines.
Now, why? Why is there this problem? Why can't they just patrol and control the air? What is it about air warfare that makes it difficult?
Well, it's three-dimensional. It's difficult, if not impossible, to police a battlefield of not just breadth and depth, but also height. Cloaking clouds and mist further complicated the issue, allowing the German scouts to frequently break through to prey on the vulnerable British reconnaissance aircraft.
Hence the casualties. So after 4th of May, the attention of High Command, where does that switch to, Gary? What's going on?
Well, it switches to the Flanders area, where a new major offensive was planned. So in effect, the Arras operations in the Bullecourt sector became once again a diversionary operation to conceal the true nature of the Allied plans.
So at the start, it had been to conceal Nivelle's offensive, and now it's diverting from the Ypres, what becomes 3rd Ypres or Passchendaele.
Yeah, I mean, Haig would have his way and launch a great offensive, bursting out of the Ypres salient, as he'd always craved. And it was here his real strategic objective.
What are they, Gary? What are they?
Well, the German submarine bases that plagued the Admiralty and the great rail junction of Roulers. They're not far behind the German lines.
Now, when you're moving aerial units about, I mean, you're going to concentrate your squadrons for the new offensive. But what happens if you move certain well-known squadrons? Like, for instance, 56 Squadron. If you move that straight away to the Flanders area, what does that make it apparent to the Germans?
Well, it would act as a sort of moving finger to direct the Germans' attention to the area of the next offensive. Instead, they were kept on the Arras front to try to fool the enemy that it remained the focus of British plans.
Now, what's the result of that? Well, one of the results of that is that the Arras is the final arena where we have someone who's been a bit of a hero of ours in many ways. They're rather the brave Captain Albert Ball. He's killed on the 7th of May, 1917. He'd get a posthumous Victoria Cross on the 3rd of June. What was his score that he, score? I mean, he was like a league table sometimes.
Well, the score, it really mattered so much to him. And in effect, that's what lured him to his death. It was in the region of about 40 victories.
Yeah, it's difficult. So they changed the sort of criteria for a victory, but about 40 would be about right. He was buried with full military honours by the Germans. They respected it at Annerlingen. One of the interesting things is a lot of people contrast. Well, it's just that the Germans made they treated him fairly. They respected him as an opponent, and I think that's quite.
Now, Ball might have been dead, but the RSC had little or no time to grieve. For the Army Cooperation Squadrons, the same old priorities and requirements endured. There couldn't be any sort of let-up in their ceaseless campaign.
No, because they're still fighting on the ground at Arras while they're on their diversionary operation now. So I'm going to be Lieutenant Charles Smart again. He takes off with an air mechanic Smith in his RE8. Sorry, it was RE8. It was a rear gunner then.
Well, especially if he shot the rudder.
Yeah, he's changed plans. They were originally in B-2Cs, but yeah, he changed by then. On the 8th of May, silly old me, that's what you say.
Silly old you. And I just said stutter, and you laughed like a drone.
Yeah, I did. That was quite funny. Especially as I'm being
magnanimous.
Magnanimous in victory.
So this is what Second Lieutenant Charles Smart of 5 Squadron
says. That was our
cricket.
I've just had a reunion in my cricket club. Our motto was dignity in defeat, outrageous arrogance in victory. What a splendid motto that was.
Yes. Tell us what you say, Lieutenant Charles Smart.
Oh, sorry, yes. We had to go quite a long way over. So we made up a strong party and flew in formation. 3 machines taking photos and 2 acting as an escort. We had got just as far over as we were going when 12 Hun scout machines came right through us. A real ding-dong strap followed. A Hun dived at the machine I was guarding, and I had to do something, so I pushed my nose down with the engine full on and dived at him, firing my gun like hell. At the same time, a Hun dived at me, and my observer engaged him with the rear gun. My airspeed indicator only registers up to 140 miles per hour, and when I looked at it, the needle was stuck right against the side, so he must have been going some. Down we swirl for about 2,000 feet, both guns firing and making no end of a noise out of both ends. You often make a hell of a noise out of both ends, don't you, Gary? And anyhow, my machine, not giving you a chance to answer, made it so hot for both Huns that they broke off the fight and cleared off east. Our other machines were all engaged, one by 4 Huns at a time, and there was no end of shooting going on. The Huns got more than they expected. One went down in a spinning nosedive, but managed to pull out after falling a good 3,000 feet. Right in the middle of the show, one of the Huns fired a white light, and off they all cleared into the east, leaving us cock of the walk. We then completed our job and came home. It was a glorious fight. I've never been through anything quite so exciting. Machines were whizzing about all over the place like mad swallows. The air resounded with a pop, pop, pop of machine guns, and tracer bullets could be seen flying in all directions. No one in our crowd was hit, but the machines were pretty well shot about.
I only got 2 bullets through my plane's these wingy things. We now call ourselves the Circus. And rightly so, for have not 5 RE8s engaged 12 Huns on their own patch and licked them hollow? Aircraftman Smith behaved splendidly through the show. He just sat on his seat like a block of wood and fired his gun like steam as long as there was anything to fire at. It's strange how little fear enters into one during a fight. I never thought of being hurt. My only desire was to kill a German, and I feel sure I would have rammed a Hun machine if I could have got near enough to do it. As for handling a machine, one can do simply anything when there is a scrap on. You cannot compare fighting on the ground with fighting in the air. The two are in about the same ratio as tiddlywinks and big game shooting for excitement. Perhaps I should not say this if I had been at a bayonet charge.
Perhaps he shouldn't say that, but it's interesting, Pete, as you sit there choking. You like to walk, don't you?
I do.
And you're a cock. So you are, in fact, a cock of the walk too.
Yeah, thank you, Garrett. That's high praise coming from you.
I've waited ages to say that.
You have.
The RE8s were indeed a very different proposition to the B-2Es that Fire Squadron had been flying for so long. They certainly had defects, but at least they offered some realistic hope of survival if correctly handled. Now, at this point, we're going to take a short break.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
For the British Scout Squadrons, the situation in the air was beginning to offer a more hopeful countenance, as if somehow the tide had turned. It was a combination of the arrival of the new types of aircraft, but also the departure on leave of the dreaded Manfred von Richthofen, the inevitable German casualties and the accumulated fatigue that was now spreading through the seriously outnumbered German Air Force.
Yeah, things are getting a bit easier more and more of the RFC and RNAS pilots were able to just get the flying time, the basic experience, the combat experience. And that's gradually changes and means that they're more likely to shoot down German planes. They become a more fearsome proposition in the air.
Yeah, as they gain in experience, their air vision, as it was known, improved, and they began to see aircraft that previously they'd have missed.
Yeah, this air vision thing is amazing. You know, you just don't see things. An experienced pilot will say, "Oh, something over there, something over there. There's three up there." Whereas the new pilot,
won't. They just won't. And they don't see the skies as being empty anymore. And that gives them lots more opportunities for action, to intercept German aircraft. Because they see them and can see them early and they can maneuver to ambush them. It's all quite exciting stuff. What else is happening?
Well, there's now an improving supply of new British pilots stepping brightly into the shoes of the dead, the exhausted and the mentally shot. Now, one such young press-on pilot was Flight Sub Lieutenant Bernard Ellis. And this is what Flight Sub Lieutenant Bernard Ellis of the 1st Naval Squadron RNAS says. Last night, I drove two down and with the help of another man, crashed a third. It was a glorious scrap. I fought one down 5,000 feet and eventually saw him off. Not crashed, but driven down. Then I found six on my tail, so the only thing to do was to fight them until something happened. Luckily, the something was another of my lot, and while he was there, I drove another Hun down. Then my partner had a gun jam, and I had four to keep going till another of my lot turned up, at which three of the four Huns thought fit to go. This other man dived on the remaining Hun and pumped quite a lot into him and drove him below me. So, as my partner had drawn off, I attacked and finished off the unfortunate Hun, who crashed. Then we were at 5,000 feet, 10 miles the wrong side of the lines, and had arches the whole way home. I found I had one strut nearly shot through and two hits from arches, one within half an inch of my petrol tank. It's a great war, isn't it?
Now, for a young lad, I mean, he's a callow young lad, isn't he? He's just callow, you know, wet behind the ears or whatever you call him. And for him, what is war to him?
Well, for him, it's still a game. Death and maiming was something that happened to other people, extras in their grand adventure story.
Yeah, they're the hero of their own sort of film or story or whatever, yeah.
Yeah, it's all happening around them, not to them.
Now, The Germans, are they oblivious to what's going on in Flanders?
No, they catch on to the British change of emphasis away from the Arras front as the offensive preparations in Flanders became more and more obvious. Slowly, the skies above Arras emptied of the predatory German albatross as they began to transfer their jesters to the north.
Now, the next quote is one of my favourites because you can just imagine that it's getting easier up in the skies for the British and... How do you think the scouts react? The scouts, everything's easier. The scouts, they've got a lot more freedom. What do they try and do?
Well, they spend quite a lot of their time trying to scare their army cooperation colleagues into an early grave.
Yeah, I mean, one of the people who was most guilty of this is Edward Mannock, who, although he himself suffered badly from nerves, he seemed to have no bloody insight into the sufferings of others. And this is a splendid quote from you, from Mannock, 2nd Lieutenant Edward Mannock, who's 4th Squadron.
The Huns seem to have been transferred to the Eastern Front. We roam all over Hunland without seeing an Iron Cross, although their archie devils are just as accurate as ever. Went out with Thompson this evening looking for scalps, but nothing doing. Amused ourselves by dodging about the low clouds and frightening the engine out of sundry crawling quirks doing artillery work. Great sport. You come down vertically at approximately 160 mile per hour on a poor unsuspecting observer and bank away to the right or left when almost cutting off his tail. You can almost hear him gasp. They're always pleased to see us about, though, and they forgive a little skylarking occasionally.
I remember some of the people we've had quotes for during this podcast series. How do you think? Just to name some: Major Alan Dorr, Captain Bernard Rice, Captain Ewart Garland, Captain Eric Routh, Lieutenant Charles Smart. How do you think they'd react to the line?
I think they'd have laughed like drains. They'd have been terribly amused by Mannock's antics.
No. We're coming to the end of our podcast on this.
Oh,
well, but we're going to summarise. We're going to have some blather at the end. Where we just discuss what we've been talking about in, I don't know how many episodes it's been, dozens, it seems like, but the myth of Bloody April, Bloody April is very powerful. What's the myth? Encapsulate it for me, Gary, in a few words.
Well, it's deceptively simple. Brave young British pilots of the Royal Flying Corps, with just a few hours training, were sent up daily to face the Red Baron and his ruthless gang, excuse me, of merciless German aces, the dreaded Flying Circus. Outnumbered, lacking even basic flying skills, outgunned and flying totally obsolescent aircraft, the young boys of the RFC went to their deaths due to the blind stupidity and intransigence of their commanders. They died like the men on the ground as sacrifices to the doctrine of the offensive at any cost.
And that is the myth. That encapsulates the bloody April myth. And it's nearly all bollocks, except for the sacrifice a bit.
But it's that legend's vital to the sentimental view of the Great War. It's a common theme it shares with other popular myths in that of innocence destroyed in futile attacks carried out for no logical reason against an impregnable foe.
Yeah, what it is the protagonists have to be seen as victims of war, victims of society at general. Is that true? Is that element true?
No, the pilots and observers of the Royal Flying Corps flying over Arras were not helpless victims cast there by some casual whim of cruel fate.
Well, what were they then?
Well, they were there as the eyes of the supreme British weapon of battle in the Great War, the artillery.
Yeah, you've got to remember, and this is what... The air battle is not a battle on its own. It's driven, it's dominated entirely by what's happening on the ground, to the troops on the ground. And that's why the missions are flown, the lives risked, and the casualties accepted. On the Western Front, could you have an offensive without harnessing the awesome destructive power of the Royal Artillery?
No, of course not. It was the guns that blasted away the German barbed wire and trenches, sought out their headquarters and the fulcrum of their communications, the guns that destroyed or subdued the German batteries, the guns that provided the creeping barrages that chaperoned the infantry across the open wastes of no man's land, and it was the guns that provided an almost impenetrable wall of bursting shells in front of captured positions to thwart any attempted German counterattacks. The Royal Flying Corps existed primarily to serve those guns by aerial photography and artillery observation.
So the real story behind Bloody April is one of selfless heroism in a greater cause, the greater cause of the Allied offensives, a willingness to fly obsolescent aircraft over the lines, knowing the risks that they were taking, in order to carry out their duty to the much larger numbers of men who were at great risk on the ground during an offensive. So that sums up that
many
side
of whom were larger than them.
Yes, they were. They're a lot larger. I mean, some quite chunky. Now, but somebody else needs some recognition, because we try and avoid using the word enemy here. We're supposed to look at both sides of the coin fairly.
Yeah, so let's refer to the German Air Force. Manfred von Richthofen and his men were genuine heroes, fighting and risking everything in the cause of their country. Richthofen is often denigrated by people who didn't understand the air war.
Now, there's a perfect example here from 2nd Lieutenant Walter Wood of 29 Squadron. Very new to the air, and he's writing home to his dad, and he gets everything wrong, doesn't he? He just doesn't know what's going on. He says this: "This Count Richthofen you mentioned, Dad, is nothing to worry about. He will soon be brought down. Believe me, every machine of ours he has brought down has been a slow, old artillery observation machine, practically incapable of defending itself." Now, what's wrong with that? He's right. A lot of his victims were artillery observation machines. What have you got to say to that? How do you answer this?
Well, firstly, Richthofen was doing the same as we were doing. The German Air Force were trying to do the same as we were. And they were trying to deny us the ability to see from the air. It wasn't about the scouts. It's about the Army Cooperation aircraft, because they could call in artillery that would kill far more Germans than a scout ever would. So, and again, you know, we talked about the aces of the air and you know, always from above, never from below. They all had doctrines, and they weren't knights errant of the air. They were there to kill. It was kill or be killed.
Absolutely. And there's a lot been a lot of mean-spirited efforts to denigrate Richtof, to say that his kills were easy, that they're fraudulent, that he's little more than a murderer preying on defenceless prey, caddish, and that he had henchmen who spoon-fed his victims. But what you're saying is that that's not true. They're all not murderers, but, well, yeah, they're all people who kill absolutely ruthlessly.
Yeah, I mean, and again, we discussed this. The Germans had a far better system of counting victories than we did. So if some of our aces, the numbers that have been attributed to them are questionable. There's never any real doubt anymore as to the identity of the victim. With Richtofen, his victory list has now been pretty well confirmed by modern researchers.
It has. Not us. Not us, Gary. Not us.
No.
Almost every claimed kill. Not all of them. In fact, we mentioned this in one of our podcasts. McCudden was one claimed victim. And he flew away. He escaped. Now, what's Richtofen's job? To sweep the Allied observation aircraft from the air. And he did that to the best of his abilities. And he does that because he knows the photographs, the clock code corrections, that's to bring massive fire down on a counterattack, that his own course. They guide unprecedented concentrations of British shells.
And this is the point I was trying to make. His enemies, the Army Cooperation Airmen, they may not have killed directly, but their hands were metaphorically steeped in the blood of hundreds, if not thousands, of German soldiers. That was why Richtofen hunted them down, because they were the real enemy. They bring in his own corps and thousands die.
Yeah, yes. So he and the leading German scout pilots, they're supreme practitioners of defensive aerial fighting to the very best of their considerable abilities in the cause of their country, Germany. Do they get away with it?
Unfortunately, most paid the inevitable penalty for continually fighting against the odds in skies, which were increasingly full of British aircraft. Hans Lubert, killed on the 30th of March 1917.
Karl Emil Schäfer died in action 5th of June 1917.
Karl Ullmann-Roeder was shot down and killed on the 27th of June 1917.
Kurt Wolf died on 15th of September 1917.
Werner Voss was killed on the 23rd of September 1917.
Erwin Bohm died in combat 29th of November 1917.
Adolf von Tutschek was shot down and killed on the 15th of March 1918.
And the greatest of them all, Manfred von Richtofen himself, broke all his own rules, as we've discussed before, and was duly perished on the 21st of April 1918. One did survive. Who's that?
Well, ironically, it was the wild Lothar von Richtofen, who, unlike his cautious brother, survived the war only to die in a peacetime flying accident in 1922.
I think he was flying as film star somewhere. We think they're heroes, most of them, by any standards, we applaud their achievements on the cause of their country. Sadly, it's against our country, but still you have to recognise that they were doing a good job.
Yeah, and remember one more factor. Richtofen and the other German aces killed their victims in the hot blood of aerial combat.
Yeah, well, our heroic British Army cooperation pilots and observers, they're, in a sense, they're killing in cold blood. And as they said, you need to keep re-emphasising the point you made earlier. They're killing thousands of German infantry, German artillerymen, via the medium, not directly, but via the medium of the guns of the Royal Artillery. So, well, let's talk a bit about them. To take me through why we admire them so much, these Army cooperation pilots.
Well, these men who took off day after day in their clearly obsolescent Army Cooperation aircraft. They're the real British heroes of the aerial campaign that formed the backdrop to the Battle of Arras.
Yep, they knew what they were doing and why. And we've had quotes during this thing that show that clearly. People like Charles Smart, Garland and the rest of them. They understood the appalling risks that they were running. And they're more
than aware of the grisly nature of the near inevitable death that awaited them in the skies. Burning to death in a falling aircraft was the most dreaded. Yeah, they keep on, don't they?
They keep on taking off, time after time after time. Many suffered the deaths that haunted their worst nightmares.
Well, I suppose others last months until finally runs out or their nerves give way and they have to be sent home exhausted to try and recover. Numbers killed, are they large, really?
Well, they're not per se, but the percentages, they're terrifying.
Now, overall, between January and the end of May, the RFC lost some 708 aircraft. That's during the Arras campaign, if you like, of which an incredible 275 were shot down in April. Total casualties for the 5 months were 1,014, of which 473 were dead, 317 wounded, and 224 were prisoners of war. Is that right? Does that add up to that?
That's a lot. Now, even with the further massive expansion of air fighting in 1918... it was only in the last 3 months of the war that this scale of loss was exceeded.
Yeah, the September, October is really big for casualties in 1918.
So how does that compare to the British Army casualties at Arras?
Total casualties, remember, were 1,014. How many casualties, killed, wounded, prisoners for April and May do we have? Say, First Army under General Horn, how many do they have? Is it more than 1,014?
46,828.
Third Army under Allenby?
87,226.
Fifth Army under Gough?
24,608. Now, that's a staggering total of 158,660, of which some 150,000 casualties were directly attributable to the Arras offensive.
Now, so what we're saying is the casualties suffered by the Royal Flying Corps pale away into insignificance against the backdrop of wholesale slaughter on the ground. But there is a point. What about that wholesale slaughter?
Well, I think what you're referring to is that it would undoubtedly have been far worse if the airmen had not carried out their duty in the skies above them.
Because there would have been German batteries, German machine guns, but there weren't because they were destroyed by the Royal Artillery, guided by the Royal Flying Corps. Was the Battle of Arras, just the last element of the myth, was it mad? Was it stupid? Was it fought for no reason?
No, there were very, very good military reasons for doing so. It was part of the Allied strategy in a global war to the death against a strong, modern, industrial nation state, blessed with reserves of men to mobilise, a war against a Germany that had by no means reached the end of her rope in 1917.
Yep, such a battle could never be postponed indefinitely just to await the arrival of the next generation of aircraft. You can't say to Haig, I don't want to attack yet because our aircraft, we haven't replaced the BATCs, we want to wait for the SE5s. How do you imagine Haig or Nivelle or the politicians would have reacted?
But even if you do wait, it's your point about the dual roller coasters. Even if you wait and you're in the ascendancy for a time, the enemy react to that. And, they have very soon become obsolescent. So you can't wait. You've got to use what you've got.
So the RFC, they may not have been ready in material terms, but they rose to the challenge. That's what we admire about them, isn't it?
Yeah, they carried out their duty and they suffered the inevitable casualties in the service of the guns that would one day bring victory to the Allies on the Western Front.
So we're saying them, and the young German aces that tried so hard to hold them back, they all deserve our unstinting admiration. And we genuinely feel that, don't we? We do admire these lads, both sides.
We do, and we hope that our podcast will be a small part in the process of recognising the sacrifices of the Royal Flying Corps, which were incurred in making an outstanding contribution towards winning the war, where in the end it always had to be won, on and above the Western Front.
So, hope you've enjoyed the series. I don't know what's next. We're planning new series all the time. But this has been, for us, a humdinger. We've really enjoyed it. And I hope you'll think about buying my book, Bloody April, which is, it's cheap as chips these days. You can get it off Amazon for pennies. And I hope you enjoy it.
And as I don't have a book yet, Perhaps you'll consider buying our joint venture, Laugh or Cry, which is out in November.
Yeah, which might be when this is out. I'm not sure when this is out. Cheers, Gary.
Cheers, Pete.
Thanks for listening to the show.
Blah, blah, blah.
If you'd like to support
blah,
us,
blah,
you can now buy us a coffee.
Blah, blah,
visit www.buymeacoffee.com/PGMH.
Or visit www.blahblahblahblah.
And we'd be jolly grateful.
Cheers.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Thanks for listening. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook to learn more about each episode. And if you'd like to support the podcast, you have a couple of options. You can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/PGMH or consider subscribing to the podcast for only £2 per month and get ad-free listening and bonus content. You can find links for both on our Facebook and Twitter accounts.
Sounds great, doesn't it?